Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I don't know whether you can hear me properly, can you? Can those at the back hear me? I'm hearing more sound now, thank you. Welcome to this special session of the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. I'm Trevor Page, and I'll be your moderator for this evening's session. A special welcome to all of you who have come from out of town to listen to our speaker, Gary Lewis, and to learn about the system he's developed to recycle CO2 emissions into plant nutrients. And I do know that it's not just Pincher Creek and the Crow's Nest Pass that people have come from. I've just met a farmer and his wife who have come all the way from Leicestershire in England, Ken and Barbara Hurd. So welcome to you from far and wide. I also see some aspiring politicians here, which is very good. We've got the federal Liberal candidate, Michael Cormican, and I see James Moore, the NDP candidate for Lethbridge West. So this has not just attracted the farming community, but also some of our aspiring politicians. The Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, or SAGPA as it's known, is a unique Canadian institution now in its 40th year. We organize weekly sessions to involve Southern Albertans in the discussion of local, provincial, national, and international issues of concern, be they political, economic, social, or environmental. SAGPA receives no funding from anywhere outside of our membership and donations from members. It's a registered society managed by a volunteer board of directors. Our treasurer, Myrna Green, is there at the table by the door that you came in through, and she's here to sell memberships to those of you that are interested in joining and or making contributions. And I would encourage you to make generous contributions and remind you when the pail is passed that paper makes less noise than silver. The format for this evening's session will be a 45-minute presentation by Gary Lewis, which should take us to a little bit before 8 o'clock. We'll then break for 15 minutes for coffee. And following the break, we'll have a question and answer period. We plan on finishing by around 9 o'clock. So our topic this evening is recycling CO2 emissions into plant nutrients. And I have to say that when I first heard about this, when I first heard that there was a farmer in Pincher Creek pumping the exhaust from his tractor into his fields, I was aghast. And I thought, oh, my God. Wasn't he poisoning the soil? And what about the side effects on the crops that he produced? But when I met Gary Lewis, and he explained about his experiments and scientific work that had been done on the process, my thoughts immediately turned to the impact that this could have on two of the world's biggest problems, hunger and poverty in the third world, and global warming. Gary has also organized a CO2 exchange to compete with existing carbon credit offset mechanisms, which he considers inadequate. Gary Lewis has been a rancher for 25 years in the exact same area his great-grandfather homesteaded 100 years ago. The Lewis family have been involved in various facets of agriculture ever since. Gary is also a licensed auto technician with specialized training in exhaust systems. As such, he combines hands-on practical farm experience and the know-how of an auto mechanic with soil science and plant nutrition, a very rare combination indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Gary Lewis.
Thanks, Trevor. I met Trevor maybe a month ago or so. In Lethbridge here, and And last week, when Dave and I come down to finalize some of the final preparations for this presentation, we were made aware that Trevor Page is a very avid photographer. He's traveled the world wide with the United Nations, and as he mentioned, world poverty and hunger and global warming. If anyone knows more about that, I don't know if anyone in this crowd has traveled the world wider than what he has. And my great-grandfather, he mentioned, come here 100 years ago and from England, and he also was a photographer. And so this evening, I want to have you more or less create an image in your own mind of what it would have been like 100 years ago for my great-grandfather to come. He had a friend that came over and pioneered a few years previous, and he was a photographer, and he really wouldn't have had any practical experience of agriculture in his own country, let alone coming to a cold, facing a cold winter, not having a home prepared to winter in. And in those days, it was definitely the spirit of the Western pioneers that helped each other survive. And if you, the point about photography, at that time, he really probably didn't realize that he was in the photo business, practicing agriculture, because when I was standing in my field 100 years later, I'm trying to think through exactly what business am I in. And I'm also in the photo business because I'm storing sunlight. And if you can put that picture in your mind, that the sun is in the sky, and that's the energy source that we're storing. And so as I go through my presentation, if you can keep that thought in mind of how did our fertile prairie soil get built in the first place, it's really the storage of carbon through photosynthesizing. And also that's what put the oil sources and the coal sources into our rich reserves below the earth, many thousands of feet deep. And that source has been buried there. It can be pulled up and used as an energy source, or we could use the sunlight in the sky today that was able to store that large amount of energy below. So hopefully you can get the picture of what I'm trying to get through when I was on my farm 100 years later at trying to make sense of this energy, agriculture energy crunch that we're in, because the energy is worth more than our food, and we're starting to burn our food as energy. So we have to think of how can all of us help each other, experimenting in our own fields and having scientists help us. And I'll go through the process, and at the end, we'll, like Trevor said, we'll have question time, and hopefully I can answer most of those questions. So who is NC Quest? I started my company in 2005, and NC Quest, the N and C is nitrogen and carbon, that I'm trying to put together that whole cycle and really understand it. And some people said, well, that means no charge. And that is really my motive as well, is that why should we be paying for our energy in agriculture when we are supposed to be an energy producer like my great-grandfather? He grew that hay to feed his horse, to pull his plow, and to take the buggy to town. And when the internal combustion engine came in, we gradually lost our place in the energy position. And today, we are a user and an emitter of emissions. So with my process of studying the nitrogen carbon cycle and taking it to a level where today we have farmers in this crowd even that are growing oil crops and using 100% biofuel and planting their crops and growing it without fossil fuel involved. So it's the fossil fuel free farm challenge that I'm trying to get across to farmers. And it's to the public, getting their understanding how big is a carbon footprint, because we hear of carbon footprint and a lot of people think that it's just 1 foot square. But the average Canadian and American emits up to 40,000 to 50,000 pounds of CO2. That means that an average acre out there across agriculture land in Canada, an average acre of wheat would possibly take in 10,000 pounds of CO2. So that means the average Canadian and American is occupying up to 4 to 5 acres. And there's not enough agriculture land that's feeding us and fueling us to take in all of our CO2 emissions because we're pulling fossil fuel out of the earth. So those are kind of some pictures in your mind that you can put together as you're going through. And I'll just... this is my first prototype that I started to... Sorry about that. This is my first prototype that I was working with my irrigation motor. It is on the Old Man River, and the Old Man River water is 8 pH, and my land is turned to 8 pH because it's always being pumped on, and I, through fertility and managing that, I wasn't able to balance that pH down to 7 because that's where all the minerals are available. So I started in the year of 2001. I started pumping water into the exhaust system and bubbling it up through water and sucking it back through the pump and taking it out to the land as a nutrient source. And I wanted to, really what caused me to start to do this is that the bomb control of using nitrate nitrogen, they removed ammonium nitrate from our market. And I'm growing Timothy hay, and Timothy hay requires a large amount of nitrogen source. And when you put urea on top of the ground, volatilization into a greenhouse gas is very high, especially when your land is 8 pH. There's no free hydrogen to turn it to ammonium. So I'm paying high dollars for my natural gas to pump my irrigation water, and I'm buying a source of nitrogen that's not favorable to grass production. And so I'm automotive mechanic, and I knew that my engine was producing some sources of nitrogen. So adding water as a solvent, it attaches to the nitrogen, and I'm taking it through the water system. And really, I was focused on nitrogen, but it came down to the fact that nitrogen was a small part of it, because the carbonic acid and the sulfuric acid that's in the emissions were probably doing more of the work than the nitrate nitrogen, because it's a very hard challenge to attach the nitrogen source to the water. You're dealing with a large volume of exhaust gases, and you only have a short amount of time, and the absorption to hot water, because of a lot of heat, you're heating up the water. And when you heat the water up, it doesn't absorb as many emissions. So it's a big challenge doing that process, and I have a lot of work to do. I've got quite a few farmers in my group that are experimenting with me, collaborating, and together we will achieve this to make it user-friendly, and so that we can achieve higher levels of nitrogen. This engine will crack over 0.5% of nitrogen is coming out of that exhaust, and most cars are down to, you know, maybe 200 parts per million, and that would be, this one's putting out it's about, I think it's a thousand parts, or it's a half a percent on my meter. So that means it's, you know, 10,000 parts per million in that range. So it's fairly high. A lot of tractors that I've analyzed on our group are running around the, you know, 1,000 parts per million, which is, you know, 0.1%. So you can make an internal combustion engine yield a lot more nitrogen sources, but with pollution control on the newer series of tractors, the NOx level is managed because that is a pollution concern. And the CO2, you can't get away from CO2. If you're burning a hydrocarbon fuel, if you're burning a gallon of it, you're going to get off 21 pounds. Doesn't matter. And what you can do, though, is have a more fuel-efficient engine. So that part we can work on. So when I developed this system, I was always dreaming of putting it on a tractor. And in the year of 2005, I finally got it achieved to put it onto our tractor and our air drill. And this engine is stationary, and the pivot is stationary. It's irrigating about 250 acres, 300 acres. And this tractor, and that's like, you know, it might have, 50 hours per, 20 or 30 or 40 acres of time, where this is just minutes of effect. And so it was because I kept studying how could I do it on a tractor and how could it influence the soil in an acre in 3 minutes. There's I studied the what's in the soil, and they said that the most limiting factor to free-living nitrogen fixation is a lack of CO2. So that triggered me that, yeah, if I could just raise the CO2 level, I would make some influence. So I decided it was worthwhile giving it a try. And the influence is, the difference is that this soil is cold, and in a very warm day, the CO2 level would be much higher because it's that organic matter is preserved. It's frozen. It's been frozen, and we got a refrigerator blowing behind us. And the microbial life and the decay of the soil is controlled by how much heat we have. So when it's cold and we're seeding our crops earlier, it's favorable to release some CO2 into the soil to do similar reactions to what the soil would do in a hot day. The microbial life on a hot day are a lot more active. So if I place CO2 into the soil on a cold day, they're going to think that it's a hot day artificially. And the microorganisms in the soil here are similar to if you were trying to preserve some food in a refrigerator. The refrigerator is controlling the decay. And if the refrigerator broke down, you would want to preserve your food with putting some salt on it. And that's a similar method that this air drill is designed to do, is to put salt onto the land. Because all fertilizers are a salt source, they have electrical conductivity. The microorganisms in the soil, they don't run away, and neither do the plants. And they're sensing their environment, and they're saying, someone used a lot of fossil fuel energy, or a cow died there, or a dinosaur left a deposit or something. And they go by that signal, and they say, we need to switch our action and denitrify the nitrogen, or we need to do a bioremediation action. And so they go dormant, or they do another job. And so the reason why I put the CO2 into the soil is to enhance their support of the new seedling. Because when I put a seedling in there, it's carbohydrate that's in the seed. And when the root comes out, the root is giving off sugars that are from the carbohydrates. And these organisms that my tractor just stimulated will be ready to interact with those extradites that come off the root. So that's kind of a overview of why, scientifically, I had a reason to put exhaust in the ground. It wasn't really an economical reason, but it was to do an experiment on whether I could enhance a crop to grow without fertilizer. It's really just a lot of different narrow scientific experiments that supported my idea, and the equipment is really just applying the science. So as I mentioned, there's two methods to the bioactive method. It's scrubbing and incorporating those emission gases into the soil. It's two different processes, and they're both challenging. All the farmers in the crowd would agree to that we've all worked together at building a prototype, getting it to the field and making it user-friendly, understanding the volume of exhaust that comes out of an engine, the volume capabilities of our air seeder fan, the speed we're traveling over the ground, the texture of our soils, the type of openers. There's a whole lot of engineering parts of it that we're working on, and we've improved ourselves a lot. The science of it, I have two scientists that are observing in Brandon, Manitoba. I have Dr. Lorraine Bailey. He's here present this evening. And Dr. Jill Clapperton. She's from Missoula, Montana, originally from Lethbridge here. So they're all hearing what I'm saying. This is my method that I've come together with. It's a theory. I'm not a scientist. I'm a farmer. Every farmer is a researcher in their own right. Every winter, they're spending their hours of thinking and putting visions in their mind of how their crop looked last year, what they want to do better for weed control or for insect control or their fertility program. And they execute that plan, and then they make an observation. And we've done that ever since agriculture has ever been practiced. So we are the original researchers. We all have the right to do that. We have the right to communicate with each other in a free country. And that's part of what I am trying to engage in, is the creativity of a farmer and their ability to fabricate and that kind of thing, which we'll cover later. So the reduction of greenhouse gases, the impact, we're taking all those unwanted greenhouse gases and using them. They're placed as a soluble carbon, as a nitrogen source, and the carbon is for microorganisms in the furrow. And we're the trace elements that are in the soil that everyone's first question might be heavy metals. And heavy metals to a mammal in our lungs isn't a very pleasant place to have them. But for our organisms in the soil and for the plants and for our nutritious food, the metals that are in our diesel fuel are really plant nutrients. And that's what I was, through the last 8 years, I've been reading different scientific books about the minerals and the essential need of those types of minerals to make the plant yield its, express its genetics. So the emissions, I have an emissions analyzer that I use across all across from the Palouse in Washington to the Swan River in Manitoba. I've gone and traveled and put my analyzer on every one of the tractors and trying to make sense of, you know, old tractors and new tractors and trying to tune them so that we get the most favorable emissions. It really depends on the thermal efficiency of the engine and the load that's on. A lot of times some farmers have too small of a tractor for their load, or some of them have too large of a tractor for the load, and it really makes a large difference. And those are things that I'm trying to help the farmer understand how to adjust their system so it's most effective. And the types of fuels we've tried, right from straight biodiesel fuel to different kinds of, you know, even the fuel from one oil producer to another could be different on the way they process it. So this is the analyzer, and I put it on the, either right on the exhaust of the tractor or else on the seed cart, and I have ridden on the back of the air drill and tested to find out if there's any escaping emissions, because that's a lot of people's question. You know, do those emissions actually attach to the soil? But the soil is a earth alkaline. It's generally got a lot of minerals in there, and the reaction that CO2 does is it's looking for some minerals to do a reaction with, because that's the start of life again. The plant took in the CO2 from the atmosphere, and it built a carbohydrate, and we eat it, and then we breathe the CO2 back out. So it's just a cycle that takes place, and it's natural to be in the atmosphere. It's just that if we keep pulling it out of the deep earth, that CO2 level is definitely going to rise. So this is part of the testing that I've done. We've got to do a lot more of it, but it's a start of it and observation to see what we can make sense of. So it's diesel fuel has sulfur and calcium and iron and silicone and a lot of micro elements in it. And the type of emissions that biodiesel make, there's a lot of information out that when we burn our own biofuel, we get a higher NOx level generally. And that's what I'm in favor of, is using biofuel that we grow ourselves and put it in our tractor and practice agriculture. So the emissions analyzing that I've done, different RPMs of the engine, there's quite a difference between the fan speed on the air drill and the mixing of it. This is actually the strength that's going in the ground. I should actually go back. I think I missed a slide. This here is the right off the engine. So at 1,500 to 1,900 RPMs, the CO2 at 1,900 is 6.6%. When you lug the engine on this type of engine at 1,500, it rises to 7.8. Plus the NOx, if you look at that, it's 2,100 at 1,500. When the engine's running slower but under a lot of load, it'll create a lot more NOx nitrogen. But when you take the load off and rev it up higher, it's just 1,000, so it drops it in half. So we're trying to achieve a 30-to-1 ratio. It's probably the most favorable nitrogen-carbon ratio for microbial life. And those are all things that we want to research in depth. So the air drill fan speed is mixing with atmospheric air. And when you mix more atmospheric air, it's going to thin it down. So we adjusted this air drill to be at 4.4% going into the soil, because the cooler system wasn't quite satisfactory. We did a lot of improvements. It was running at 159 degrees Fahrenheit, even though we had a lot of cooling system on there. And that's really, a lot of people just think, well, I'll just build a system real quick and be out there in the spring. But it is really overwhelming when you get out there and try and put a crop in and you don't have a good enough cooling system and you've melted down your plastic pipes. So our group is prepared to help any farmer to get it so that horsepower matches their cooler system and the exhaust cooling system, and the fan speed is set at the right speed, and those kinds of challenges. So what we've observed with the crop yields and the growth and the expression of the plant is across this past year, 200,000 acres. The farmers are reporting that they're getting a similar yield to fertilizer plants. There's definitely challenges with weather. There's definitely, this does not remove all risk. Farmers know the risks of agriculture. Putting out a large amount of your income to get your crop to grow, and you're gambling with the weather and breakdowns of your equipment or whatever it might be, there's a lot of considerations, and we hope to help farmers through those times of when you make a huge change in your method of agriculture. Like when zero till first started, a lot of farmers were taking huge risks just working their soil once and putting seed and fertilizer in the ground. And this is probably more difficult than that decision. And you need a support group to get you through. So my first experiment in the year of 2005, Pinch Creek area got 35 inches of rain, probably one of the wettest years in history. And a lot of the land was challenged with too much water, because my system doesn't work underwater. It's an aerobic system. It needs the air. But the fields that we planted, the neighbors down here seeded with the traditional fertilizer, and we used our swather and our combine to harvest it, so we know the yield production. And the National Research Council was working with me since 2003, observing the work I've been doing, and they got this picture from a satellite picture to sort of find out if I was just dumping on some fertilizer out there to trick them. And so they got this picture, and this is the field with exhaust. You can see it's very smooth, it's all even, and it's a different color, and those are oats, and these are oats. And so they were convinced that maybe exhaust did do something, because I reported that the yield on this field was twice as high as this bumper crop. So that's sort of my first excitement, is that it did yield, and expressed its genetics twice as many bushels as a traditional fertilizing field. So it made me really go back and look into why did I do this and what's happening. And that's what's driven me to keep going forward and have other farmers heard of this. They phoned me up and they wanted to do it. So I said, let's work on this together, because I can't convince Ag Canada or anybody to look into this, because it's just too new. So it's taken that long to get to this point today where we did 1,000 acres that year. And the next year we did 20,000 acres. This past year about 200,000 acres. This up and coming year, we're not sure. It'll be quite a number of acres. So my question was, after I grew that crop, is what's happening in the soil? And so I went to that same field, and I took a rototiller with exhaust application on our three-cylinder diesel engine, and I took a check strip with no exhaust, and then I took a check with some exhaust put in with a rototiller. And I sent it away to ANL Labs in Ontario to find out what's the biodiversity change. And you probably can't see that from there, but it was that the aerobic bacteria in the soil was 32, and the lab says that a good soil should be at least 10 to 1 ratio. And this soil, after put exhaust in it, it's 400 to 1. So I stimulated some aerobic bacteria, and the lab said that's a good thing for soils to have a higher level of aerobic, because the anaerobics are the ones that carry the disease in the soils. And so this is anecdotal. It's one test, but I did do this many times on my own observations so that scientists have something to go on, that it's worth designing a more complex experiment. The next question was the free-living nitrogen-fixing bacteria. Do I colonize them? And so it's 9.8, 10 to the 6th power. And when I put exhaust in, it's 2.1, 10 to the 7th power. So I didn't kill them. They actually reproduced. So that was just a quick observation to see, is there a toxic condition or is there a good condition? And I've tried many different tests. It depends on the kind of fuel you're burning. There's a lot of complex things depending on the type of soil. It could be just even the fuel you're burning that could make a difference. No, I don't want to turn the power off here. So I did the soil mineral tests, and when I put exhaust in, every mineral on those two tests, from a check to emissions, the emission side was enhanced, every mineral. So I don't always get that result, but on that test it did. And it brought the pH to more balance towards 7. This is a bit acidic soil. It brought calcium up, it brought phosphorus, it brought zinc and manganese and boron, and just every element was enhanced. So down in Brandon, the first farmers that collaborated with me is Daryl Carlisle and his agronomist, Calvin Jarvis, and Dr. Lorraine Bailey. And they're, as a team there, observing their observations with putting emissions in the soil and practicing my method. And this is a crop of oats, and it expressed good genetics then too. It would have been probably a double yield there as well. So I worked with potato farmers in Idaho. They also heard what I was doing, and they wanted me to come down, and they did 80 acres of potatoes, 40 acres with their method, and 40 with mine. And in the summertime, we went out there and observed the potatoes. On my side with exhaust and my method, there was perfect sets of potatoes. On the other side, the potato hill had large potatoes in the top and smaller potatoes in the hill. And that's because the hill was salted with fertilizer, and the roots hit the salt and quit growing, and you get small potatoes deeper in the hill. So if you keep your electrical conductivity from being too high and let your minerals be available and let the organisms in the soil have the right environment, they'll support that plant. So in wheat fields in Alberta, we're out doing some tissue tests to see if they're deficient or not. So the tissue test comes back, and nitrogen is in the high range. And every field that we use emissions on, I haven't yet seen one that's deficient or low. They're generally in a sufficient range, and high and very high. The only thing on that test is phosphorus is a bit down, but in reading about phosphorus that we traditionally use, we're loading the seed zone. It doesn't give the fungus a chance to interact with the root, and that root fungus that's naturally able to interact with a root can store up very large amounts of carbon, because the plant goes by signals and the fungus goes by signals, and it decides that it's got to get a lot of carbon to the root so that the fungus has the carbon source to go and find phosphorus and to find copper and zinc and manganese and water and calcium balanced. So that's what, I'm not too alarmed if it is down a bit. And this is the difference between a fertilized field right across the fence to the emissions one. The fertilized field was probably seeded a bit earlier. But in the heads, you can see that there's copper deficiency in a lot of these heads. They're empty. And ours, they're full. The grain is plump, and it's heavy. And we have observed heavy grain in most situations. So in canola as well, canola is a naphthalic plant. It can use sodium as its water pump. And when it's feeding on nitrate, nitrogen, natural sources of nitrogen in the soil, so it expresses itself differently. It's got branching from lower down, and it has a very good tap root. It doesn't interact with the fungus as much in the soil, but it is a powerful plant with big leaves. And we've had satisfactory results with canola. Depending on the organic matter of the soil, it is a plant that can't take large amounts of heat. But I think if we have the right conditions, emissions and canola are a good match. So wheat as well, with the heat coming on in our most situations, the summer is getting hotter. And this is with emissions, it's already got a head coming out. And with fertilizer, it's really making a lot of leaves. And the head is down the boot yet. So in dry land agriculture across the country, we will get our crop to be into maturity sooner and beating the heat, because we saw it this past year where heat was the issue. It run out of water, and yields were affected by that. So peas are another crop that we've experimented with, and legumes, it's unreal what we do see. The colonization early in the soil helps the bacteria affect the root sooner. And you'll get nodules right to the tip of the root, and you'll get plants that are really twice the size. So the tissue test as well is higher in nitrogen, where you put exhaust, because the nodulation happens sooner. The plant's healthier, and the check the nitrogen isn't as high. So instead of the emissions going up into the atmosphere, we're treating them, we're blending our fuel, and we're capturing them and cooling them, and we're directing them to the air drill system. We've done a lot of prototype improvements since this one, but it's an example of all those volatilized carbons are going into the airstream and taking the seed to the soil and burying it with the seed. So in Brandon, Manitoba, the colony down there collaborated with me, with Daryl Carlisle as the distributor there, and they decided to grow their whole farm on just emissions this last year. They used some foliar spray, but this corn was grown with two passes of emissions and about 2 pounds of nitrogen and about 4 pounds of phosphorus. And they also used a highly energized sugar source and enzymes on the soil to trigger the microorganisms in the soil along with emissions. So it was beyond, I believe, of what they thought they would get. They felt they were taking a big risk, but they were willing to do it, and I think that they got enough silage this past year. So there's 100 million acres across Canada that a tractor passes over. and there's 10 pounds of CO2 emitted every tractor pass on a zero-till situation. So that's 1 billion pounds of CO2 less going into the atmosphere if we could all do this process. But the big factor is our fertility. The fertilizer that we use is a lot larger source than our internal combustion engine of emissions. So it's 90 billion pounds of CO2 from just 50 pounds of nitrogen on 100 million acres. And so if we're trying to correct the CO2 levels, the emissions from agriculture, from groundwater pollution, those sorts of things, we've got a long ways to go in agriculture that I believe my method can make an influence there. So, as I mentioned, incorporating the emissions and reducing fertilizer uses and improving the plant's ability to store more carbon from the atmosphere. Because that plant, when it's not on fertilizer, it's going by signals and it says, I've got to feed the bacteria in the soil, I've got to feed the fungus in the soil, so that in its own survival, it will get enough nitrogen. Because an alfalfa plant is very efficient at putting bacteria right as a nodule, right effectively in the root. But the corn and the wheat, they're not as effective because they're not a high protein plant. They have the ability to interact with free living nitrogen fixing bacteria, having close root associations or free living out in the soil. But that is what I put the exhaust in the soil for, is because it said they were lacking CO2. And so if I can put extra CO2 in, and I can get my plant pulling more CO2 from the atmosphere, every acre is cleaning the atmosphere of more CO2. So I started a carbon exchange, CO2X change, and it's every farmer marketing their carbon management change to the public, because today the Alberta government is launching their industry carbon management. And I believe that if it's you and I, myself as a farmer, the public as a consumer of fossil fuel, enjoying aircraft flight, a cruise, or having two or three cars in the yard, if you enjoy that, then your carbon footprint is how large. The average Canadian and American is 4,000 to 5,000 pounds of CO2, and the average acre would be 10,000 pounds of CO2. So it takes it to be that we have every person is occupying up to 5 acres of agriculture land photosynthesizing. So if we can get our agriculture land to be farmed on fossil fuel free, that's a challenge to my farmers, to become fossil fuel free. And my challenge is to the public to get their carbon footprint to fit onto 1 acre. So our acre is going to take in more CO2, and the public is going to make their carbon footprint fit on 1 acre. So you can go to our website and read through it. Every acre that is managed this way goes through Google Earth. It's documented that way so that the public can actually take ownership of their carbon management, and the farmer can make his farm become more effective at taking in those oxidized emissions from fossil fuel. And the thing that our site is geared to is that the agriculture fuel, the biofuel you buy, if it's 10% ethanol or a biofuel of 20%, that's exempt because it's recirculating in the atmosphere. So if we can achieve that by helping the public understand where their emissions go and helping the farmer realize that he's in the carbon business and he's got to get more effective at capturing it and using his own fuel. So our farmer's website is NCQuest. It's actually bioagdiff.com, and it's the place where the farmer will, through the login on the side there, they will go in there and they will manage their carbon, report their acres that they're using the method on, and their method of agriculture, whether it's zero till or continuous cropping, whether they're burning biofuel, types of foliar spray, and whether they're using a fertilizer source. So if the farmer is fossil fuel free, he gets 80% of that carbon trade. If he's just putting exhaust in the ground and using all unfavorable practices, he would get 50%. So it encourages the farmer to become fossil fuel free, and the public can sponsor him to do that if they want their carbon footprint to fit on 1 acre, and if they want the balance in the atmosphere to be favorable to slow down climate change. So our future is experimental development of the equipment and to track the just making this thing more user-friendly, the mineral changes in the soil, the biodiversity, and trying to document whether this free-living nitrogen fixation is actually happening, and that's all the work for the scientists. So I want to acknowledge at this time the family farm that has supported us across the country. They're the ones that are sponsoring me to be able to go forward and help them and to get it around the world. And it's really only funded by them. It takes their efforts and their creativity to make this happen. Oops. So this is one of our units that I made in the foremost area. And there's 60 of them out there, and every one of them's different. So it takes the creativity of the farmer helping with what I've learned and what my distributors have learned. And altogether, we're helping the farmers achieve a method that is ours. And the farmers are definitely taking ownership of it. They have a website to market their carbon management. And we open it to the public to sponsor an acre. And that acre card that was handed out tonight, if anyone missed getting one, there's more on the back table. That is 1,000 pounds of CO2 discount from 1 acre. So you can go to the website, you can punch the number in there that's on that card, and that'll give you 1,000 pounds that we'll sponsor you, and that's 50 gallons of fuel approximately. So we eventually will have that so that fuel companies will have it so it swipes like an air miles card, and it'll keep track of your emissions, and it'll give you maybe some kind of fuel company discount because then they're being responsible. And so we don't have to have this sequestered carbon method because there's not enough acres in Alberta to take even a small part of the carbon that is on intensity emissions away. So that's pretty well concludes my presentation, this part, and we'll do questions in 15 minutes. Thank you.
Gary, thanks very much. That was fascinating. And we're going to break now, everyone, for 15 minutes. There's coffee and cookies, I gather, over on the left over there. And I'm sure we've got lots of questions. So we'll see you in 15 minutes.